Attention crew, this is your Captain Caliban speaking. This is a supplemental episode of Enterprising Individuals, where we bring you news and tidbits from the world of Trek, also interviews with special guests, and a few little surprises along the way. Happy Pride Month to you and yours, and to our LGBTQIA+ listeners. I hope you have plans to celebrate, to get involved with the continuing fight for LGBTQ rights, and educate yourself about the struggles of LGBTQ people asking for respect and equal treatment. You know, Pride Month isn't just the time when Target tries to sell you rainbow-themed merchandise, which, by the way, I don't hate. I got a few myself this year. But Pride Month is also significant because June 28th, 1969, marked the start of the Stonewall Riots, where the people of Greenwich Village fought back against the harassment they received at the hands of the police and the oppression that anti-gay laws and legislation put on them. It's a time to party and parade and celebrate with friends, but also a time to remember that the fight goes on and that pride means never letting anyone tell you you have to be something or someone you're not. As you celebrate pride this year, and there's a lot to celebrate, remember the reason for the season. Speaking of parties and celebrations, my guest on the show today is Dan Devey. Dan is the founder and executive director of Gays in Space, a nonprofit organization dedicated to promoting the importance of LGBTQ+ character inclusion in entertainment, and in science fiction in particular. GIS has hosted over 100 events across the country, attended by thousands of fans, with appearances by celebrity guests and Trek stars, and the pandemic has not slowed them down. Since last year, they've had nearly 30 virtual events to raise funds and awareness for groups like the ACLU, National Queer and Trans Therapists of Color Network, the Hollywood Food Coalition, and Feeding America. And presumably had a hell of a time at each event. Who knew activism could be this fun or involve this much glitter? If you want to know more about Gays in Space or find out if there's an event near you, go to www.gaysinspace.com. That's GAYS in space. Sound it out, but you have to do it like that. That's it. Enjoy my talk with Dan. I did immensely. Imminent ties the fully automated luxury gay space party time. And with that, let's get underway. My guest on the show today is Dan Devey. Dan is the founder and executive director of Gays in Space, a nonprofit organization dedicated to promoting the importance of LGBTQ character inclusion in entertainment and science fiction. Dan, welcome to the show.
Aaron, thank you so much. I have to correct you, though. You didn't say it right. Say it with me.
I'll put some reverb under
there
that.
There you go.
I debated doing it that way. That was the correct way to say it, of course. It's great to have you aboard. I always ask first-time guests to the show how they first discovered Star Trek. When did you become a Star Trek fan?
Very funny story. When I was a kid, the best times that I had were when I got to spend time at my grandmother's house. When I would sleep over at Nana's house, that's when the fun would be had.
And sure.
Every night at 11:30 p.m., WPIX in New York would play The Honeymooners, Jackie Gleason, and like ever since I was, before I knew what comedy was, I was laughing with Jackie Gleason. And immediately following that was Star Trek. And I don't know why, but for some reason, every time the promo came up after The Honeymooners saying, next up, Star Trek, I was terrified by it. I was like,
really?
What is going on? Yeah, was absolutely terrified. Until one night when, and this is how old I am, it was before we had a remote control. You didn't have to get up to actually change the channel. I just didn't get up. And the episode that they played was Mirror, Mirror. Arguably one of the best, you know, episodes of Star Trek. And I thought, wow, wait, this isn't scary. This is actually pretty good. And then the next night, get this, they played The Trouble with Tribbles.
Okay, and sure.
So it was the universe saying, Dan, you need to be a fan of Star Trek. We're giving you all their greatest hits here. So that's how it happened.
That's a hard downshift from Honeymooners into Star Trek, I guess, for a little kid.
Yeah, yeah, seriously. You know, from the black and white and the you know, the lovey but screaming relationship to the Spock and Kirk. It was jarring at first.
I was like that as well as a kid, or just I guess the way that I was I was always kind of scared of things like that. And there's nothing really, sure, there's some scary things and there's monsters on Star Trek, but anytime any adults were taking something really seriously, and especially when it was in a colorful world like Star Trek, I always just got real nervous about that. And but I kept watching, of course, and that's how I ended up being a Star Trek fan as well.
Isn't that weird? Isn't that strange that we would have that same completely ridiculous reaction?
Yeah, I don't know what it was. My mom got me one of those, this is how old I am, one of those small records that comes with a book when I was a little kid. I loved Spider-Man, and she got me Spider-Man versus the Man-Wolf. And whenever the Man-Wolf would be near, there'd just be this howling sound, you know, like a wolf or a werewolf howling. And I would just run out of the room, and I never heard the rest of the record. I don't know what it was. Or like when I used to watch Bill Bixby and The Incredible Hulk, I just thought it was a show about this kind of schlubby guy that goes from town to town, because whenever he would get mad, you know, his eyes would turn green and he'd start going, "Arr!" And I would get scared and run away, and I'd never see the Hulk parts. So it's a very boring show about a guy who's just drifted from town to town for me. I know that you worked as an entertainment journalist in the past and as a movie reviewer, and you worked for Rotten Tomatoes covering junkets for them. I host a movie podcast on our network called Craft to Services, where we talk about movies that were critically reviled, but that audiences embraced. And one of the subjects that we end up discussing often on the show is the philosophy of aggregate reviewing, like sites like Rotten Tomatoes, Metacritic, providing an overview of a film's critical performance. What do you think about the use of aggregate reviews, and do you think they've changed how movies are perceived by the viewing public?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it put me out of business. It put me out of the game. You know, once social media really took hold, and, you know, I always used to say when I was doing it, like, look, here's my opinion, but my opinion isn't worth any more or less than yours is. This just happens to be what mine is. And then when social media took over, and suddenly everyone's opinion quite literally had the same heft and weight to it.
Yes.
I thought, why am I busting my butt trying to stand out and trying to, you know, because my approach to things was always very, it was, I don't want to say serious in like an academic sense, but I took it very seriously. And I took the critique of film very seriously, because good films, like good plays, like Shakespeare plays, you can read or you can see over and over and over again and always find something new. You can always draw something new out of it, some new perspective, some new experience. And I was in the minority, shall we say, when things like YouTube and podcasts and things started taking over. It became very much like, you know, the popcorn blockbuster and who's sleeping with who in Hollywood and who's that baby. You know, and I just had no interest in that whatsoever. Yeah. There was one, I did a red carpet at the Paley Center for 1 year for the Vampire Diaries. Uh-huh. And the female lead of the Vampire Diaries apparently was in a relationship with both, at one point or another, she initially hated the first guy who played Stefan, and then she started dating the guy who played the other brother, and then they broke up, and things changed on the show because of that. And now, I don't know any of this. I'm there on the red carpet and I'm talking about the show. And I asked her a question and she thought what I was asking was something about her relationship.
Okay.
And I found out later, I was like, girl, I don't know you. I don't know where you live.
Right.
I don't know your story. Like, I'm talking about your character here.
Yeah. So I guess
it's less fun.
And I guess it's just the march of time. You know, I guess that's just the way that it's going to be now. I miss the old, you know, Pauline Kael or Roger Ebert reviews of old, the sort of thoughtful essays. A lot of that's moved to YouTube now. And something that I really enjoy on YouTube is film essays on YouTube. People taking, you know, these sort of longer, deeper looks at TV shows and films. And so I'm still kind of getting it there.
Yeah, when things like that happen, it's great because that was in brevity, if you haven't already picked up on this, is one of my weaknesses because I just kind of keep going.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I would put together these reviews, or I would sit down with actors, directors, and in the editing process, you know, I will have had half an hour, 40 minutes with them.
Yeah.
And then it's like, okay, you know, if you want your video to be popular on YouTube, you better make that under a minute or a minute and a half tops.
Right, right.
And it's just like, what could you possibly say in a minute or a minute and a half of substantive film critique?
Yeah.
You know, or like, I mean, just getting to say hello to the guy and, you know, like,
yeah,
great job, and blah, 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 blah. Like, you want, you know, so
yeah,
that's why I ended up, I mean, I did it for almost 2 decades. I was in it for 19 years, almost 20 years. And 15 of those years, I ran my own entertainment website, thecinemasource.com.
Yeah.
And for 15 years, you know, but it was a struggle to keep the lights on with that.
You have to immediately ask about the two boyfriend situation. Like, second you sit down, you got to get into that. Or something you see a lot now in these small junkets, they'll have the actors put a hat on or like ask them funny questions or something like that. Obviously, just trying to, you know, make something that's YouTubeable or you can put on Twitter.
Yeah, exactly. And I also just grew so tired of the same questions being at, like when we would do roundtable type settings or... You know, the same questions. I felt after a while, it should be like Wheel of Fortune. Like, you know, when Wheel of Fortune started, they would ask you what letters you wanted in the final puzzle. And after like a decade or more of everyone always choosing those same letters, they switched the rules. Okay. So now at the end, they're like, we're just going to give you all the letters we know you're going to choose. Then choose three different ones. And right. Then you get to do it. And it's like, I always felt like press junkets should be like that. Like, here are your boilerplate standard answers.
Yeah.
Boom, 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 boom. Now, someone with an original thought in your mind, please say something.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that being said, how did Gaze in Space get started? I'm sure that's a question you get asked a lot, but I can't avoid it.
Oh, no, I love it. I love that question because unlike... The Cinema Source, which was 15 years of me really having to push and really having to work extra hard to keep things going.
Yeah.
Gaze in Space is the first thing that I've done where I haven't had to. In fact, it's I have to just try to keep up because it clicked with people and I didn't need to convince people. I didn't need to put it clicked with people and it caught on. And it started actually because I had been wondering, why are there no gay people in Star Trek?
Yeah.
You know, it's this utopian future imagined by Roddenberry. There's no poverty. There's no greed. There's no disease. There's no war. There's no racism. Where are the gays? Like, why don't we see any? Mm-hmm. And over the years in my interviewing and working junkets and stuff, I completely abused my authority and made sure that I got to interview every Star Trek actor I could possibly corner into a room.
Yeah.
So anytime they had projects going on, I always made sure that it was like, yes, I will cover, you know, the latest, you know, Transformers movie or whatever.
Sure.
But I am also going to give equal coverage to the Trekkies documentary with Denise. You know, mm-hmm, like mm-hmm. Whenever things like that would happen. So over the years, I really have gotten to know a lot of them very well. And Rod Roddenberry, especially, I was interviewing him for the release of his documentary. And I asked him, I said, you know, how come no gays in Star Trek? And he said, you know, it's really interesting that you asked that. And this was when we were first kind of getting to know each other. So I remember he was very kind of, he was tiptoeing a little bit because he wasn't sure if I was going to be one of those really sensitive gays or I was just going to be cool.
Okay.
And so he was very, very tiptoe. But he said, you know, one thing that I've heard, and this is not me, I'm not saying this, but one thing that I've heard from a certain part of the fandom is that the reason you've never seen a gay person in Star Trek is because it has been cured by the 24th century.
Oh my God.
Right? And it was like, when he said that to me, it was this wave, like, whoa, wait a second. Because not only is it horrific to think that this is what people were postulating, you know, amongst themselves in their little red corners of the United States.
Yeah.
If you believed what they did, which is that being gay was wrong, it makes total sense that curing it would be the reason why we have never seen a gay person on Star Trek. It's logical if you accept the falsehood that being gay is, you know, a problem or something to be corrected.
Yeah. It's kind of a sci-fi, at least a old sci-fi thing too, because I know I've heard Gene talk about how they wouldn't need like jails or lawyers in the future because we could just cure criminals. And that's a very like 50s sci-fi kind of idea that totally leaves out just the reasons for crime or why somebody would find themselves, you know, in front of a judge in the first place. So, gosh, I hope, I'm sure that he didn't really feel that way, Gene.
Oh, Roddenberry. No. And
yeah.
That was another reason why Rod was so nervous.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, right.
What he really wanted to say was like, Dan, listen, even amongst Trekkies, there are bigots. And this is what the bigots are saying.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, that's...
No, he grew up with two gay uncles. He was like, it was never a thing ever in my house. And he said it was something that his father always... You know how when you're building something, you have to start, you know, with the foundation, and then you get to build and build and build. And you know what? It was like, we had to wait our turn. There were other groups that needed that were first in line. Like, I hate to put it like that, but they were. And one thing that he always regretted was that he was never able to do right by us in the time that he had.
Yeah.
You know, he had to pick his battles, and he just could not have achieved everything else that he did, and also us. Which made sense to me.
He's such an interesting guy, Roddenberry, because I think in a lot of ways he seems like he wouldn't be exactly ally material. You know, he's like this old World War II vet. He's a white guy. He was a cop. And he comes up with this idea for a series where everybody's going to be equal, black, white, male, female, you name it. And yet there's still, you know, there's a lot of coded racism in early Trek stories. You know, you got the sexism, the pro-war episodes, a lot of conventional American values. And then the years go by and he gets older and he's ramping up the production of TNG, and he's talking about regretting the sexism in his early work in life. And he's saying it's time for gay characters on Trek. He's getting woker, as we'd say now. And yet he still can't write a good Crusher or Troy episode. You know, there's still no gay characters. We get things like Code of Honor. You know, it's a long road towards enlightenment.
Yeah. But he did, you know, he did try a couple of things to, because, you know, so many things in Star Trek happened simply because they were able to get it past the censors.
Yeah,
you know,
like, sure.
They just didn't know the whole black and white episode.
Yeah.
The Last Battlefield.
Yeah.
You know, like the idiot censors watched it and they were like, oh, how ridiculous is this? And it turns out to be one of the most powerful civil rights statements like made on television at the time. And
sure.
They were just like, oh, I don't get it. But one of the ways that he tried to include us was background. When the Next Generation episode Justice came around,
yeah,
the way he saw that episode was he's like, all right, our people are going to beam in. And when they beam in, I want to see half naked women kissing men, men kissing men, women and men all like intertwined. And it's just going to be like an orgy, and that's what we're going to do. And I think after Rick Berman had his heart attack, he said, okay, can't do all that, Gene. We'll give you the hot ladies. We'll give you, you know, one or two attractive men, but there will be no, you know, homo business going on there.
Right.
But he tried, bless him, you know, he really tried to get us in and like, because that's all you need. One scene like that would have prevented people from being able to guess that we had been cured, you know?
Just sure.
thing.
Yeah, just having just something, at least a quantum of representation. You know, you mentioned Rick Berman. I think that there's been two really big obstacles, other than just circumstance or censors, in making Trek the actual progressive future that it aspires to be. And one of them is the custodians of Trek, you know, the people who were left in charge of it with Gene's departure, of course, chiefly among them, Rick Berman. And a lot of people have said a lot of things about Rick Berman, all of which I'm sure he deserves. But his own personal sexism or homophobia aside, he always claimed that his main mission was to, you know, quote unquote, preserve Gene's vision of what Trek was. And you hear that from other people who were in leadership positions like Maury Hurley or Brandon Braga. They all claim that everything that they did was to preserve Trek. And ironically, I think that they ended up holding back a franchise whose entire mandate was to lead the way forward in representation on TV.
Yeah, very well said. That's exactly what ended up happening. And I think that now, all these years later, after we have seen documentaries like Chaos on the Bridge, and you know, we've started to hear the dirty details that were going on behind the scenes,
yeah.
I actually feel badly for, because I was on the hate Berman train so hard at the time, because anything that happened that I wasn't happy with, I blamed on him, and everything that was good, I credited to somebody else.
Yeah.
And, you know, in retrospect, looking back at it, now I realize, like, wow, there are, yes, he, by all accounts, wasn't the most progressive guy, and, you know, but
not exactly.
It didn't really, I don't think he made the studio's wishes, which is was his job. His job was to represent what the suits wanted,
yeah,
and to kind of bargain between the two, bargain between the suits and the artists. I don't think he ever made it suitier, you know, for lack of a better term. I think when he pushed for something that was just ridiculous because the suits wanted it, he would, but he would never want anything worse than what they were pushing for.
Yeah.
So, you know, so I think he gets a bad rap in that sense.
Yeah, possibly. I think that we're really lucky at this point in time, though, to have creators like Brian Fuller and Alex Kurtzman behind new shows, you know, on Star Trek Discovery, and also the writing staff on Disco and Picard, making those deals. I mean, I'm sure that, like, you know, if you bring, God, I hate to say his name, but like, if you bring something like this to Les Moonves and go, we want to do a show with LGBTQ characters, you know, main characters, we're following them around, he probably would have said, no, this is a streaming service. We need to get people in. We need to get people watching this. We don't want to rock the boat. But people like, you know, Alex Kurtzman and his writing staff have continued to push the envelope and push things forward to the point where we're just, you know, seeing representation like it's not a big deal.
Yeah, exactly. It's finally, Star Trek is finally doing what it was supposed to be doing all these years.
Yeah.
You know, there every new series was a new step forward for society. You know, it was in Next Generation, women were finally seen as more than, you know, cocktail waitresses.
Yeah, they could wear pants. Yeah.
Yeah, they got to wear pants and be in charge of security.
Yeah.
And then we get Deep Space Nine, the first African-American captain. Then on Voyager, the first female captain. And then we get to Enterprise. And Enterprise was supposed to be when we got our first gay something. Didn't have to be the captain. We right. weren't even hoping for the captain.
Yeah, yeah.
We would have been thrilled if they just would have admitted that the freaking chef was gay. If they had said the yeah. chef was gay, we would have been all on board with that.
Right.
But by that point, it had been I feel the creative team that really knew Star Trek were so burnt out. They were really, you know, as they say, strangling the golden goose to get just one more egg out of them. And so the really creative people who understood it were burnt out, exhausted. So they weren't fighting with the studio execs nearly as hard anymore, because yeah. it's like, you're going to be beaten down after all that time, and you're going to find, just give them what they want, give them what they want. So that's when, you know, Enterprise was really kind of the moment when Star Trek said, we are not pushing any more envelopes. we are only going to do stuff that's already been done and that makes money. That's our new mandate.
Yeah.
Until Discovery. And then thank goodness that it, you know, Discovery helped to reclaim Star Trek's, you know, Star Trek's birthright, which is to move things forward, to move the needle forward in society.
Yeah. You were mentioning fandom before, and I think that it's amazing that fans have been a huge factor in pushing Star Trek forward to be more inclusive. But the other obstacle that I see holding Trek back is fans who just can't get over themselves. I mean, it's incredible to me to think that there are somehow racist and sexist and homophobic Star Trek fans still. Like, what show do they think they're watching? Like, what are they actually getting out of a show like Star Trek? And there's even fans who wouldn't consider themselves like racist or homophobic, but they're not helping either. That's how institutional discrimination works. You know, when you say, I'm not racist, I don't hate gays, I just don't know why they have to make it political. That's an endless refrain that you hear in some circles in Star Trek fandom. And, you know, like, don't make it political. It's a political show. It's a show about freeing people and people being able to pursue their lives and potential. And there's somehow fans that still don't get that.
Yeah, which is absolutely mind-boggling.
Yeah.
Just like you said, it's like, what show are you watching?
Yeah.
Don't make it political. It's like, how have you ever seen the show? Have you ever?
Yeah.
Like, it is mind-boggling that there are people out there who are United States Red, who voted Trump, who are scarily anti-vaxxers. How the hell are you anti-science and claim to love Star Trek?
Right.
That just doesn't... It's like, what? How does...
I only like fictional science, like warp field theory. There's a lot of characters, obviously now on Discovery, Picard, we've got, you know, real deal three-dimensional LGBTQ characters. But there are more than a few characters from previous series that fans have focused on as being non-heteronormative, either subtextually or just full-on headcanon. This person is 100% not straight. We just never ended up seeing it on screen.
Yes, definitely. And that's, you know what that is? That's what we did. That's what gay people did before Will and Grace.
Yeah.
This is what gay people did. We would search for...
Yeah, just looking for yourself.
Something. So, I mean, Judy Garland, Wizard of Oz, you know, a friend of Dorothy. It's like, wow, how desperate were gay men to find, like, I can see inside this little girl, a gay man who's trying to get out and telling my story. It's just like, when you have very little to choose from and you see just that little glimmer of recognition, you will glom onto that and it will sustain you, honestly, until, you know, things eventually got better.
Yeah.
So they totally did. I mean, Dax was... I mean, such an incredible character, such an incredible idea for a character. I mean, they were doing trans rights issue shows without even realizing that that's in fact what they were doing.
Yeah.
Because, you know, as long as it has taken for plain old regular gay guys like me to be reflected on screen, it's taken so much longer for other members of the community to finally be recognized and for them to be seen for the unique human beings that they are, you know, what their experience in the world is like. You know, people get so used to the community, you know, the LGBTQ plus community, the gays, they're so used to lumping it all together.
Right.
Which I understand, because it's basically like, all right, we've got 5 minutes to talk about stuff. The gays get 10 seconds of that. So it's all the gays. You're just, everybody in there could, we don't have enough time. We don't have enough time.
A monolith, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. When in fact, you know, our community is so incredibly diverse. We're all so different. The experiences we've had, you know, how we've grown up, the challenges and struggles, all so different. And it's only slowly beginning now that the community is being properly spread apart. And people are realizing that, okay, you know what? A gay man's experience is not the same as a trans person's experience, you know, that a male to female trans person is not the same experience as a female to male. Like, there are huge differences.
Yeah.
And just slowly now, things are starting to open up where we can start learning more about that. That's honestly one of the most amazing things about Gays in Space for me personally is how much I have learned about my own community. Yeah. And how much, you know, I have so many amazing friends because of Gays in Space that I never would have met before, because our circumstances, our lives would never have crossed paths were it not for Star Trek and then Gays in Space bringing Star Trek people together.
Yeah.
So that's one of the, and also the first gentleman of Gays in Space, my boyfriend, my partner, yeah. My partner, we met because of Gays in Space.
Well, that's great.
A friend of his came to a Gays in Space event that we did in New York very early on. And he said, oh my God, Rich was living in San Francisco at the time. Mm. He said, Rich, you've got to check this out. Gays in Space. And Nana Visitor was at the party that he was at. And it's like, this is so great. You got to check it out. So he said, okay. And he looked us up and he saw I had posted a video on YouTube about, you know, what Star Trek means to me. And there were one or two small things about Gays in Space up there. And we just so happened to be doing a party in LA the following month. So he saw that video and he said, that guy, if I can meet somebody like that guy, we're in business. And so the day of the event, he was down to his last $24 in his bank account. He spent it on a bus ticket to get from San Francisco to LA, came to the party, and then at the end of the party, back on the bus, back to San Francisco, because he said he was not going to miss this opportunity. Mm. And now here we are 5 years later, or 5+ years later, and, you know, wedding bells are starting to chime. And,
that's great.
You know, all because Gays in Space.
Yeah. Well, can you talk about the types of events that you're putting on with Gays in Space?
Yeah, absolutely. So when we started, the thing that was really the most unique about our events was that, you know, when you go to a convention, the actors are there,
yeah,
and you can stand online and, you know, pay a bunch of money for them to autograph something.
Yeah.
If you're lucky, you get to talk to them for maybe 10 seconds because they're like rushing everybody through.
Right.
Yeah, like same thing for photos. And this is something that I think a lot of people don't realize. The actors don't like this fact any more than the fans do.
Yeah.
This, like, you know, conveyor belt way of doing things. When we do our parties, because I think it's because no one was really expecting anything to come of it, that, like, when Nana came to our first event, our very first event in Vegas, it was supposed to be one party. I was going to throw a party to celebrate the fact that there were finally gay people in Star Trek after Star Trek Beyond came out.
Right.
And so, you know, she told me, she was like, Dan, I can come, but I can probably only stay for like 20 minutes or so. And I was like, no, hey, that's great. Just having you there is amazing. She stayed for 3.5 hours. Like, I had to put her in a cab to get her back to the hotel. Because she had so much fun. And then the next day she said to me, she was like, whenever you do anything, any more of these, I'm there. You just tell me and I'm there.
That's so great.
And it just kind of caught on. And so without us planning it, what we created was a mix and mingle human way for fans and the actors to get to know each other. It's not like, here's $50, please sign this and then I'll get out of your hair.
Right.
It's like, hey, you want a drink? You want a drink? Come on, I'm gonna get you da da da. And then, you know, we have a cocktail, we laugh, whatever. Enjoy, you know, we do a lot of performances and stuff at our shows. We always try to keep things fresh and entertaining. And the actors have just as much fun as the fans do. And it's all because you have that human connection that the conventions just don't give you. The Cruise, on the other hand, now the Cruise gives you the human connection that is fantastic.
Yeah. It always amazes me. And I know as an entertainment journalist, you've talked with many, many actors who probably cover a whole range of enthusiasm levels for doing interviews or being involved in events. But it always blows me away that so many Trek actors and personalities are so down to meet with fans or support charities and organizations and just have a good time.
We are so blessed as a fandom. And I oftentimes will say this during our events, because there's nothing worse, because like you say, I've met and interviewed like probably everybody. There's nothing worse than having your hero turn out to be a dick. So disheartening. And then it's like, okay, not only were you not cool in person, now every time I go watch one of your shows or your movies, I'm gonna be thinking to myself, yeah, but he was an ass.
Yeah.
Star Trek actors are almost all, one or two very rare exceptions, they are all truly wonderful human beings. They really, really are. And we are so lucky that they are the people who play our heroes.
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of fandoms, not that lucky, but we as a fandom are. And that's something I always try to remind people that, you know, remember, this is really special. The fact that, like, someone like John Billingsley, who played Phlox on Enterprise.
Yeah.
Billingsley, I mean, he's been a character actor forever. Like, if there was a TV, he was on it at some point. So many movies, such a diverse career. Right now, what he does full time with his time now is he runs the Hollywood Food Coalition.
Yeah.
Which to me, I've never seen someone more dedicated to charitable work than John Billingsley and his wife, Bonnie. Like, they are just outstanding. And Billingsley started with the Hollywood Food Coalition as just, he wanted to help them to raise money and, you know, he would help spread the word or whatever, but that was all that he was going to do. And now he's running the thing because it's just, you know, when the opportunity to help, he can't turn down. And yeah, he's so smart. And yeah, it's Bob Picardo too. Picardo is another one who his commitment to charitable organizations, particularly science-based I mean, he's with the Planetary Society and this event that we're doing on the 6th with CasperiaCon was an event. The idea behind that event was, let's bring together actual infectious disease professionals who are fighting COVID right now with the Star Trek actors. Or Star Trek doctors, I should say. And when we pitched the idea to him, he said, you know, I've been saying this for months. I don't know why this hasn't been done before. You know, connect the love of Trek and science with an update. What's happening now? People are scared. People are very concerned to be flippant about anyone's concerns about getting the vaccine or not getting the vaccine. It's just not, it's unfair because people, I mean, it's all rooted in some kind of fear that people have. And if anyone is going to make you feel safer as a Star Trek fan in that type of situation, it's a doctor. It's one of the doctors.
Yeah.
You know, like the EMH telling you, listen, it's gonna be okay.
Right.
You know, I mean, he didn't have the best bedside manner, but still, he's a Starfleet doctor.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Just picturing the doctor yelling at somebody to get vaccinated.
Right.
What's it been like to transition Gaze in Space to a virtual space with the COVID lockdowns?
That has been very interesting and was something that I wasn't sure we were going to be able to do. When COVID lockdown happened, it happened right after we got back from the cruise.
It was the second year
in a row that we hosted events on the cruise, and it was just amazing. Like, that, it's my favorite week out of the year. Vegas, Star Trek Vegas used to be my favorite. Now Star Trek The Cruise is my favorite, and Vegas is a close, you know, is second to that. So when we got back and we saw what was happening, I thought, whoa, okay. So how do we take something that has really taken off because of the personal, in real life, physical interactions we're able to create for people, you know, fans, yeah, celebrities, same room, have a drink, talk like friends. How do we translate that to something that is virtual? And, you know, this is before everyone knew that you could do a Zoom thing. You know, Zoom things weren't really a thing yet.
Yeah.
So when it happened, the first thing we did was I created a campaign, the Gaze in Space trading card collection, because I wanted to do something that was virtual that let our followers know that they were still a part of us, we were still with them. And so people would, Gaze in Spacers would send in photos of themselves either wearing Gaze in Space gear or wearing their favorite cosplay. And we would Photoshop that onto a cool space background. And we created this series of 52 like baseball cards, like trading cards.
Oh, cool.
But it was all, you know, it was all Gaze in Spacers. And it was just something to do because we thought maybe this won't be so bad. Maybe we'll be back in a month or two or whatever. Right.
Yeah.
And then, you know, when it became obvious that that wasn't going to happen, I went the Zoom route and I said, God, I'm not, it's so sad because I'm such a fan of Star Trek and technology, but I really loathe social media and learning and having to learn new tech. You know, like I just feel like, God, can't I just be an old grouchy man on my lawn yelling at some kid for running across it? Why do I have to learn how to tweet and Insta and like, but I do. So I learn it. And so when I really looked into what Zoom could do, I thought, okay, you know what? We can do something with this.
Yeah.
Because we'll still be able to have the fan and the actor on screen talking to each other in real time, seeing each other. So that's pretty close to what we do. So we did that. And one of the first ones that we did, we had Kate Mulgrew and Bob Picardo. Garrett Wong surprised everybody with a question for Kate at the beginning of that one. And it went super well. Like super well, everyone had a blast. Everyone had, you know, not as good of a time, obviously, as they would in person, but it was a lot of fun. There was that connection. And we discovered that, you know what, we are now expanding our audience because tons of people can't get to New York,
yeah,
where we do our weekly events,
yeah,
or to Vegas or LA or the cruise, and they miss out on all of this stuff. Well, from now on, they're never going to miss out on anything else because now that we've learned this, this will become a part of our regular in real life routine,
yeah,
when that starts up again.
Yeah. I was thinking about that, about how it just sucks that, you know, you can't do your events, but this is kind of a blessing in disguise because it just works as outreach. Or like what I know that you've done, like panels at WonderCon and AwesomeCon and places like that, like people who would never go to a Gaze in Space event, can still see you at conventions and learn more about your efforts and get thinking more about representation in media. And, yeah, just, you know, it was worth learning Zoom.
Yeah, it was. You know, I have to admit it. You know, I have to take off my cranky hat. It was absolutely worth it, and it's an incredible thing. You know, some of when we were doing all live events, I was meeting people. Like I said, meeting Rich, my best friends in my life came because I was meeting people at these events. When we went virtual, that didn't change. Like right now, yeah, the people that I talk to the most, that I spend the most time, that I enjoy the most are people that I have met only via Zoom. Like people that we have never shared the same oxygen together. And yet I just adore them. And it's crazy. It goes to show that the format, where it happens, how it happens is ultimately irrelevant. If you can find and connect with other people who believe the same things that you do, who have the same passions that you do, everything else falls away. You can find a way, you know, like absolutely. What is the, what's the Jurassic Park quote? Nature,
life finds a way.
Yeah.
On Zoom.
On Zoom. Yeah. Who would have thunk it?
I know that you have met an impressive list of Trek stars through your work in Gaze in Space. Anyone that you were particularly excited to cross paths with?
Oh, well, let's see. Denise Crosby was my first Star Trek actor that I interviewed. And this was when I started out at WNYU Radio. I went to NYU and worked at the radio station. Sure. That's how I got my start interviewing and doing movie reviews and stuff. And Denise also happened to be my very first on-screen crush. Sure. And meeting her, because, and I'll never forget this, I flew out to LA for a week in the summer, and I lined up as many interviews as I could possibly get. So, and it became a tradition. Every summer I would go out there, I'd do an interview tour, and I'd come back with enough material in the can to be able to cut together my entire season of my interview show for the radio station. And so we met at the, it was a restaurant in some very fancy hotel. I forget, it was like a Four Seasons or something. And she was already there, and I walked over, and it was one of those situations where, you know, like the finger sandwiches when they're on trays on top of themselves, and it's like a, like an accordion of food on top of food, which to me, you know, hey, I'm a kid from Staten Island who is probably, I was 18 at the time, 19 at the time. That was class as far as I was concerned. And so just knowing that I got, you know, walking over and meeting her, and the fact that she was just so fun and so chill and kind was really kind of, that was the moment when I knew that I could be closer to my love of Star Trek than I ever thought possible before.
And she's Hollywood royalty too. So that's, it's great that she's so down to earth.
Oh yeah. Yeah. She's absolutely amazing. And like I met John Billingsley and Bob Picardo are so incredible. J.G. Hertzler, oh my God, my chancellor. He is just, oh man. You know, I actually wish there was video on this because, okay, very quick story.
Sure.
He lives in upstate New York near the Finger Lakes. Mm-hmm. My partner's family just got a house like maybe half hour away from him. But it's the Finger Lakes. There's not much going on out there. So to welcome us to the neighborhood, he bought me a camouflage, like hunter's cap that is bedazzled with jewels. So it's like the gayest hunter, you know. And so he was like, welcome to the neighborhood. And I was like, okay. He said, yeah, Dan, you know what? Don't wear that. Just whatever you do, don't actually.
One of the hosts here on our network is a huge Worf fan, so I would be in a lot of trouble if I didn't ask you about hashtag We Want Worf and your campaign to try to get Michael Dorn back on TV as Worf. You know, now in 2021, we've got several familiar Trek names, actors returning to the screen in new projects on Paramount Plus. Do you think a appearance by Worf could be imminent?
First of all, thank you for asking that question.
Sure.
Because that, the We Want Worf campaign, that came, it was CinemaSource, and then We Want Worf campaign, and then Gaze in Space.
Yeah.
So the We Want Worf campaign was the first piece of work I was doing that was focused on just one thing. You know, I wasn't jumping from movie to TV show to movie.
Yeah.
It was like, no, we have a mission here. And the mission was, when I was interviewing Michael in Vegas one year and talking about the show and how he has pitched it and what the status was. And the night before that, I had watched Friends up in my hotel room. And it was the Friends episode where they say about sending people baskets of mini muffins. So I just, you know, like often, Michael, you know what you got to do? Man, you just got to send these people some serious baskets of mini muffins and they'll say yes, they'll sure. do whatever you want. And it was just a throwaway comment until Michael Dorn said, mini muffins. I was like, whoa, did we just strike internet gold here? What? So I created this campaign telling people, listen, if you want this Worf show to be made, hashtag we want Worf,
right,
buy mini muffins from this one bakery, and we will gather all these mini muffins together, deliver them to Les Moonves on the CBS lot,
right,
with a note saying we want Worf. And it was just dumb enough to work. It was just silly enough. And when I pitched the idea to Michael, you know, I said to him, I was like, and you know, like, they're not going to keep the mini muffins, so obviously we would donate everything that was sent in to a local food bank, so that it's not just, hey, help us make it, you know, it wouldn't be Michael just saying, hey, help a millionaire make another show for himself.
Yeah,
there was a charitable component to it, which is what Trek is supposed to do.
Yeah,
you know, so we were able to do that. And on the day that we delivered we delivered close to 70,000 mini muffins.
Wow.
And we delivered them in a white and pink mini muffin bakery van driven by an in full cosplay Klingon and a Vulcan ambassador next to him.
Well, okay, nice.
Wow, was that fun. And so it's been, you know, the actual process has been very up and down. I mean, we did that before Discovery was even a thing.
Yeah, right, right.
You know, like the question wasn't, can Worf do it? The question was, should Star Trek be back on television?
Yeah, yeah.
And now, yeah, I mean, we've been up and down and all around, and it's the kind of thing where I believe it will happen. Eventually, it will happen. Michael is, the greatest thing about Michael Dorn is that you could say to him, you could say, Michael, you just won the lottery and you now have the cure for cancer to give away. Or you could say, there's an asteroid headed for Earth and we're all about to be annihilated. And his response to both would be exactly the same. And it would be, interesting. So he's not, you know, he doesn't get real worked up about
it. Sure. That. Yeah. Yeah. Rain or shine, yeah, he's good to go. He's just gonna go fly a jet airplane and yeah, let me know when the show's on.
Exactly. That is exactly it.
I absolutely want to see that show. And also, I was wondering about other sci-fi shows. Like, what other sci-fi series do you think are really nailing representation right now?
The Expanse.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
If you haven't seen The Expanse, and it took me a while to get into it because it's one of those shows where every season, they're very different from one another. There isn't a real established tone that remains throughout. And I found the first season's tone to be off-putting. It wasn't really connecting for me. Mm-hmm. And the star of the show, Stephen Strait, is an actor that he's from The Village, you know, went to school in New York, and such an incredible guy. He is somebody that I, for his very first movie, interviewed him one-on-one. And then from that point on, he had new projects, like one or two per year. And it became a tradition that we would do our one-on-ones and then, you know, maybe a red carpet or whatever. So we really, you know, as close as you can come to saying you became friends, it was like we got friendly.
Sure.
And so I was super excited for the excuse to be able to say, hey, Steven, we got to talk. We got to do something, man, with this show. But I couldn't get past the tone of that first season. But when I finally did, thank goodness I did. The second season moving forward, it is, because the whole gay, straight, not an issue. It's not an issue. It's handled beautifully. Yeah. It is not, they don't focus on it. They don't highlight it. They're just people. And, you know, if they happen to be attracted to the same sex, that great. If not, who cares?
Yeah.
So I love that.
And there are gay villains as well, but it isn't a part of, you know, it's not a part of their villainy. It's like you said, it's just every character is just sort of who they are. And you know, and it's not, they don't fit into stereotypes or anything like that. I just think that's really great.
Yeah, exactly.
Steven seems like a guy who, like Michael Dorn, who's real sedate to talk to. Is he like that?
Very much. He is a very chill,
yeah,
introspective, but like, you know, the guy who will make a really, really funny joke, but you don't realize it's happened until 15 seconds later.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, like that type of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he was also in a movie called, I want to say it's called Lifelike.
Okay.
Absolutely. Anyone who has any interest in sci-fi, LGBT issue, watch this movie. I'm not going to say much about it because the less you know going in, the better.
Yeah.
But it is brilliant. It was a very like quiet release, you know, an indie type thing, but the quality, the storytelling, his acting is just, oh my God, it's incredible. Absolutely incredible. And not that it matters, but he is halfway naked through so much of that. You got to throw that out there.
Sure. what was the male witch high school movie that he was in? Where he's in it, the guy, the Winter Soldier is in it, and it's just like 75% just guys in towels, you know, running around with that shirts on.
Yeah, the oh my God.
Yeah.
Covenant.
The Covenant, that's what it
Covenant.
Was.
Yes. Oh, bless the people who made that movie. Ooh, yeah, that was like, you know, when you eat all of your dessert at the same time.
Yeah, like, right.
You just skip the meal and it's totally fine.
Dessert buffet.
Exactly.
Well, Dan, thanks so much for joining me today to talk about Trek and
Gays in Space.
Where can people find out more and where can they go to donate to Gays in Space?
Absolutely. We are on, you know, we're on all the socials because I had to make it happen. So we did. So we are on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and it's at Gays in Space, 3 A's in Gays, 3 A's in Space. For all of those, you can go to our main website, which is www.gaysinspace3a's.org. And our YouTube channel, you can find, is actually still from my CinemaSource days. Mm. So if you go to youtube.com/thecinemasource, you will find not only all of the Gays in Space videos, but you'll find some very heavily gay slanted interviews with all the other Hollywood actors.
Okay, great. Yeah. And are there any upcoming events that people should know about for Gays in Space?
Yes. So we have KesperiaCon that's happening on the 6th, which I believe is this Thursday. Mm-hmm. We will be at Star Trek Vegas again this year.
Great.
We will have at least one, probably two panels that we'll be doing while we're there. We will have, it looks like we're going to be able to actually do our big Saturday night party, which we weren't sure if we were going to be able to do it because, you know, do 600 people really want to cram into a gay club, you know, and be close and whatever, but everything seems to be up and running and people are feeling good about it. So it's not going to be 600 people. It's going to be a lot less, maybe 200 people or whatever.
Sure.
But we'll be able to do that. And the thing that I'm really most excited for is we are going to have a block of time every day between the ending of the daytime events and the beginning of the nighttime events. We're going to have 2 hours every day where we host a new Trekkie game show.
Ooh.
So we will have Trekkie Feud, we will have Trekkie Jeopardy, we will have a Trek-themed Quiplash Jackbox night, we will have Trekkie Pyramid, all sorts of, just, I am going to be embracing the hell out of my inner 70s game show host.
Yes.
I can't wait. So we're going to be doing that. And then next year, the cruise, we're back on the cruise again. Super excited for that.
That's awesome.
You might be seeing us pop up in a couple other areas as well, not just science fiction, we've started expanding into actual science and science research and the future and, wow, you know, gaze in actual space.
That's amazing. But
I'm not allowed to say anything more.
Okay,
about
say no more.
Yet.
Keep an eye out for that. Yeah.
Very excited for that.
That's awesome. Well, thanks again for joining me.
I'm Mikan Hana.
And I'm Caliban.
I'm a huge Sailor Moon fan. I've been a Moonie since the beginning. I've seen every episode, every movie. I've read all the manga. I love it.
I've got a head full of bad wiring and I've never seen a single episode.
Do you want to join the wonderful world of Sailor Moon?
Okay. Enter laughing. It's hard to believe that that was us. It feels like ancient history.
We recorded that a few minutes ago.
Ancient history, but now that I'm a Sailor Moon expert.
You're not an expert?
But I'm trying.
Every week on Sailor Noob, we talk about a new episode of the original Sailor Moon series.
It's all new to me.
And I'm a little more seasoned. I've been a Japanese language student and I've lived in Japan.
And you use your experiences to talk about the food, fashion, and culture of every episode of Sailor Moon.
What do you do again?
Share in the wonder of a classic anime series.
Good enough. Sailor Noob is a great companion for first-time watchers, and it is a fun hit of nostalgia for the experienced fan.
You can catch the show every Friday wherever you get your podcasts.
And you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr, posting all things Sailor Moon.
One day I shall be the master.
Let's just get through this series first.
Okay.